You're listening to John Ely in the Afternoon on BBC Radio Suffolk, and I'm going to be with you through until 3 o'clock. Coming up, my guests in the studio include Frances McLown, and she's, well, a fascinating story to tell. We'll be talking about flying boats and Phoenix Days, so if you remember those days, perhaps you could phone up a friend who also remembers those days as well, and stay tuned. You may even remember Frances herself. 50 years ago, on the 16th of March, and I think it was the 5th of March or the 4th of March, was the Clydebank Blitz. I think that's what we said, Frances McLaren, didn't we?
The 15th, the Ides of March.
Ides of March.
15th and 16th was the Clydebank Blitz.
And you were exactly sitting your exams at that time.
My final exams, yes.
And you knew nothing about what was happening at home?
Not really. No, I had actually gone home for one day of the Blitz,
mm-hmm.
because I was in between papers.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother piled me on the back of a lorry the next day. And that was the last I saw of them for about a week. But I had to carry on and do my papers, sit the rest of my exams.
Did you know what was going on in Clydebank at the time?
Well, only second hand. We could see the bombs. And the second night was the worst, because they were landmines the second night. The first night it was ordinary incendiaries and explosives. But the second night they were really landmines. Great damage was done. And they mistook the road for... And they mistook the Clyde, they mistook the boulevard, which was like the bypass of Clydebank, and they bombed all the sort of the houses there, the residences there, and they didn't really do much damage to the shipyard or the engineer works. And that's how it came. But as I say, I got back, sat my exams, and then I managed to contact my people after a week. By that time, they'd gone to Ayr.
Mm.
My father, he worked in the shipyard in John Brown's.
Mm.
Helped to build the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth.
Really? Goodness me.
He was a specialist in iron, wrought iron.
Yes.
And he used to do one-off special jobs for all the luxury cabins.
Yes.
And that's how it came to be.
Well, Frances McLown, it's a long way from Clydebank down to Suffolk. And the journey that she brought you there is filled with chance, because if you hadn't met a certain man going home to a friend's house, you may never have found the inspiration, I believe.
Not really. I was really intending to go to university to be a maths and a science teacher. But my young friend, I used to coach her in her maths. She was a bit weak. And one day I went home for tea and her father said, "How would you like to come and work for me?"
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought he was joking, because we used to watch the aircraft from the classroom windows taking off and landing. And it was so exciting. And he said, "Yes, I really mean it." So I discussed it with my parents and that was it. I thought, this is life.
What was his profession then?
Oh, he was one of the top scientists.
And working on?
On the seaplanes and the bombs and the various things like that.
And we're talking about 19...
That was 1941. Just... The beginning of December, 1941.
And you were about 16 then?
Yes.
Just 16.
I was just 16, because I had to have permission from my parents to fly as a flight observer. And of course, I thought it was nothing else but my father to sign it.
Mm.
But my father said, "Oh, let's see, lady, now. Let's see this." I thought it was nothing. We didn't see the danger.
Yes.
And even then, I didn't see the danger. But now I see the danger as I look at the photographs and look back.
Now, tell me more about those early days and the work that you were involved in.
The initial work was on the hull launching tank. It was a tank where model hulls were attached to this sort of ramp.
Mm.
You picture like an escalator going down,
mm-hmm.
and these model hulls were attached to this ramp.
Mm.
And on the bottom of the hull were placed little diaphragms,
mm-hmm.
and there were little diamonds with levers. And as the hull hit the water,
mm-hmm.
the diamonds were displaced and caused a scratch on a little metal slide.
Mm-hmm.
And we could adjust the hull for different angles, different weights, different speeds.
And where was this actually? Still in Clydebank?
No, this was in Roo on the Gearloch.
Ah, I see.
In Gearloch, that's where the RAF station was.
Mm-hmm. And so you were actually really involved in top secret work.
It was, yes, it was
very
top secret work. Well, that was done on the model scale, and it was also done on full scale on the aircraft as well.
Mm-hmm. How were you treated, being such a young person in this very scientific and very important world at that time of the day?
Well, right from the start, it was a case of you were one of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
There were no other women to start with,
mm-hmm.
and it was so new, there wasn't even a ladies' toilet for me. I had to make arrangement in the village tea room to visit there, and there wasn't even a scale of salary.
Really?
It so happened the head, the equivalent civilian CO was called the superintendent. That was like the group captain, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a wage. Mm. And actually, they were going to alter it later, but I couldn't alter it because I had travelling expenses from Clyde Bank.
Mm.
But eventually, they let me stay, and the work was successful. And being in the ground floor, I got all the practical experience. I didn't get my BSc because I couldn't get to university. But I went to technical college, and I went to electrical science, and I had studied physics and chemistry, the basics, you see.
Mm.
And, of course, the practical experience is what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So after these little diaphragms were recorded, and it's rather interesting too, it was all German equipment, and eventually we ran out of supplies of the little slides. But these little slides, I used to take them into a dark room, and they would be magnified up. I actually had a machine called a Metaphort. It was a Bush machine, equivalent to a microscope, and it would be enlarged up, these pictures, and I would take the various tracings, and I would be able to tell the pressure that had been on the hulls on the various areas. And of course we got the best way to distribute the load, how to arrange the CG of the aircraft, what wind speeds to land in, what sea conditions to land in to be safe and economical. And then of course there was the stressing of the hull bottom itself, not just seaplanes, but if a land plane has to ditch, it has to be stressed so that it won't crack up like an eggshell. Well, people would say, well, just make it very strong. But then that reduces the payload, and it needs more petrol to fly the aircraft. So you had to get that X factor. They still have it today, the X factor. You'll hear if there's an aircraft or a train crash, they always go for the little black box. Well, what happened? All the recordings, everything that was used in the aircraft, all the controls were fed into this box.
Even in those days?
Even, it was a started in those days. Now it will be refined, done electronically. But there, we used to call it Heath Robinson. That's what it was.
What brought you to Felixstowe? How did you come to be with us here?
Well, the aircraft station came back to Felixstowe after the war.
And what were flying then? What were the names of the boats? What type?
Sunderlands.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Coronado and a Granada. Mm-hmm. They were Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the Catalina. And we also had the models. Again, we had the hull launching tank.
You've got some pictures here.
Yes, that's the sign there.
Now, is this a model I'm looking at, or the real thing? This is the real thing.
No, it has a model hull attached to it, as you see.
I see. Oh, I'm with you now. Right. And where were these taken?
These were taken at Felixstowe.
In Felixstowe, on the docks there. And you were working on the design of these then?
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. They weren't. They were taken to Helensburgh, at Roo.
Helensburgh.
Because that aircraft actually crashed.
Ah, come just sit a little bit. Ah, that's better than you.
The aircraft actually crashed.
Did it?
Yes. I might have been on that aircraft, and my husband might have been on it, but it so happened I had a cold, and I hadn't been passed for flying, and he chose another aircraft, or he could have chose that aircraft.
You had a lucky escape.
We had a lucky escape, yes, these things.
What was Felixstowe like down there in your days? What was Felixstowe like for the flying boats and things when you came down here? What did you make of it?
Well, after the war, it was very windy. That was the first thing I noticed when I first came to Suffolk. But it was also a station waiting for the air crew to be made in civilians, you see. And it was a very relaxed atmosphere, but the work still continued because the ditching test still had to be done. And it so happened the man who was in charge of the station, seaplanes were very popular because he was the man, he had the control. But it so happened there was a Saunders Roe Princess, which was the largest seaplane ever built, and they always had trouble with it because it was underpowered. The engines were underpowered. It was a six-engine aircraft. But one day, and it cost £1 million, which was a great deal of money in these days.
Incredible amount of money.
One day, somebody left the vents closed for all the generators, the engine generators, and at 6 o'clock one morning, it went up in flames. So that was actually the end of flying boats, the beginning of the end of flying boats.
Now, why do you think they did have an end? Because they seem to be a very
because
sensible...
Because Mr. Gardner retired and then he died.
Ah, was he
and
a man...
And he had a great influence.
Yes.
He was a very learned gentleman.
And he was a sort of pioneer of flying boats in many ways.
Yes, he was greatly interested in flying boats. And of course, flying boats were ideal because you didn't need to have a runway. And they were the only big aircraft in being at the time. Mm. Now we have the jumbo jets, etc.
They were bigger than the normal land planes then?
Yes, they were. Mm. They were. Now, the men who worked with me, I have a photograph here.
Oh, yes.
One of the men was a Director General of the Concorde. I shared an office with Jim.
Now, who's that? What's his name? Jim?
James Hamilton.
Yes. And where was this picture taken?
That was taken at Felixstowe.
Second on the... This is a wonderful photograph of a gentleman in their RAF.
The back row, second from the third from the left.
Right, and he was...
Director General. He went to the RAE when it closed down at Felixstowe. He was Director General for the Concorde on the English side.
The Concorde project. Did you work with him?
Yes, I worked with him. Now, the gentleman next to him, he was the one that explained about Yuri Gagarin's...
And his name was?
John E. Allen. Mm-hmm. He went to Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, they were both real whiz kids. We were what you called boffins. Now that term's used today in scientific circles as scientists, but the actual definition of a boffin is you're a strange bird without wings that flies. That's what boffin really means. But some people just apply it to scientists, men.
What sort of projects were you working on after the war then? And what were you...
Well, of course, the dangerous ones were during the war, like the dam busters and the anti-submarine ones, they were during the war. Mm. We did the anti-submarine ones in 1941.
These anti-submarine aircraft?
Yes. Mm. You remember the wolf packs
that
were the convoys coming across the North Atlantic?
And the U-boats attacking them.
Exactly. Well, it was vital that they had to stop that. Mm. So that's when they developed these rockets. Now, these rockets were attached on the underwings, just like bombs are, on a Sunderland. Mm-hmm. And we went to the island of Islay. The town of Beaumont.
Good whiskey from my area.
Yes, it was. And we went out there. And again, I was the only woman. Yeah. But because I had the experience, they let me go. That was a case of that. Mm. And we did these trials. And it was a little Canadian pilot, Lieutenant Squadron Leader Reed, I think he was. Mm. They were all excellent pilots because they were all test pilots. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was the aircraft, it was about 2,000 feet. He would start his dive, then he would release the rockets, then he'd start to pull out the dive, and then at the very bottom of the dive. Now, all these readings had to be taken on instruments, and I would sit in the second pilot seat. Now, today, it's done electronically, but now, in these days, I read it. I was the instrument.
You lived dangerously.
Yes. Well, of course, you didn't feel dangerous when you were young. Death was for somebody else.
Yes, and not for you. Yes, that's
right. And this is what happened. And, of course, the pilot got so proficient, we ran out of dinghies, because the dinghies were simulated submarines, you see. But it didn't take long to really develop them, and they went into practice, and, of course, that was a great breakthrough.
Mm. Incredible that you got through all that sort of testing and things like that. In Felixstowe, did you fly up from Felixstowe to places like Islay to do tests, or did you do testing around?
No. When we came back to Felixstowe, that was it. Mm. The other place, it was wartime conditions. The dambuster thing, it was done in the war.
Now, what did you do with the dambusters then? How were you involved in that?
Well, it was so top secret, I didn't know. I just knew it as a highball.
Oh, I see.
And I was placed in an office. It was in a big house. Mm. Headquarters was a big house.
Mm. In Suffolk or somewhere?
No, in Roo. In Roo. During the war again. Mm. And, there were two rooms which were the servants' quarters, and to get through them you had to go into the kitchen, and we had the RAFA regiment there. Mm-hmm. When we left the rooms we had to lock the office doors, but we didn't know what it was, we just knew it was something very top secret. Now they were doing tests in Scottish locks, and they were also doing tests in Welsh locks. Mm-hmm. Now what happened, you've seen the documentary films,
haven't you? Yes, yes.
Well, the next time you look, and this is what I tell my friends, look for a little white dot on the ball as it drops. Mm. Now that was the indicator, that was the thing that I measured. I could tell the speed, the angle, the impact, etc., the distance and all the things. Without going into technicalities, that was the sort of guideline for me. Because you see, if they made the ball too heavy, the aircraft couldn't carry it again, you see that all that weight. If they made it too light and small, it would break up when it hit the water. So they eventually got it just the right size so that it bounced along the top of the water until it hit the dam wall, and then it would slowly sink, and then it exploded. Mm. Not until it sank.
Had you any idea of what the implications of what you were doing were? I mean, not the specific mission, the dam busters mission, but you just knew this was for breaking up a dams. And,
yes.
And
for... Well, we knew that afterwards. Mm. I only got the films to analyse in the back room, in the dark, and many an eye-burning session we had. And as I say, when I went out even to the toilet or to go to pick up my supplies or anything, I always had to lock the door.
But you could have made decisions which influenced that mission if you'd got it wrong.
Well, it would have taken longer. Mind you, I didn't have the final decisions to make. There was the big wigs. I was a very small fish in a great big sea. But nevertheless, the humdrum work has to be done by someone, and done accurately, too.
Did any of the famous men of the day come to this research or cross your path while you were involved?
No, I lost contact with them. Because after I left Felixstowe, I went to Martlesham. But even after the war at Felixstowe, we did air sea rescue work on rubber dinghies.
From flying boats?
For flying boats, for any aircraft.
Right.
For ships, you'll see in ships. And they're the same rubber dinghies that are being used today. Probably they've improved them with valves and the thickness of the fabric and the setting, but they were the very same. There was a 5-6-seater without a canopy. There was a 5-6-seater, I meant 5 was comfortable, 6 emergency.
See, right. Yeah.
And then 5-6-seater with a canopy, 5 comfortable, 6 emergency. And then there was a 9-12-seater, 9 comfortable, 12 emergency. And then there was the K-type dinghy, that was a single pilot's dinghy. You've seen them.
Yes, I've seen them.
Crawling into them. Yeah. And we developed these. I would do the tests in the laboratory, where it had to be kept cold and things like that. And it was long, drawn-out session, testing valves and letting them inflate and seeing which was the best valve. Because if somebody's ditched in the water, he may even be injured. But he'd certainly be suffering from shock if he lands in water, especially if it's cold. So he wants a dinghy that'll inflate quickly and safely and that he can board. You see, it's all very well in a swimming pool where we do tests.
That's right, but at sea when it's choppy and things
like that. Yes, whether you're in the heat, tropical heat, or Icelandic cold, things like that. So they were vital. And we also had a wooden boat, air sea rescue boat, and it was actually attached to the bottom of a Lincoln at Martlesham. We used to go from Felixstowe to Martlesham, and it would be attached there. And it had a series of parachutes. And it would be dropped, and again there would be films taken by a photographer on another aircraft and in a boat, and I would have these films, and I would take the various measurements and things that happened, but it never really came to anything. It really wasn't a very successful venture.
It was something which still was one of the less successful.
Less successful, but they did try it, you know.
Do you have a special love of flying boats?
I do, yes, I do.
What's so special? What really makes you?
I think it was because working there, as I say, you were one of the boys. You were never thought of as a girl, though they had respect for you naturally as a woman. And of course, being the only girl there, I had lots of privileges. And of course, I got all the privileges of the services, but I didn't have any of the duties to do, fire duty and be an overnight duty and things like that.
Frances, we've been talking about your career as a researcher with flying boats, with rescue devices, with bombs, with so much which was a part of the world 50 years ago, well, 45 in some cases, and the post-war period. What was the most exciting project you felt you've been involved in?
The one with the anti-submarines. I actually knew what it was being used for.
And which was unusual, I suppose.
Yes, it was.
I suppose in a way it was fairly obvious, didn't it?
It was. It was. We had to. I mean, it was told that you were simulating submarines, and you use a rubber dinghy. And then that was the cry, we've run out of rubber dinghy, so we've no more submarines. But by that time, it was really a success. And of course, many of the tests you have to keep doing again and again and again to perfect, just like in your instruments for precision. But we didn't have to do too much on that. And it was very vital, and it was a great breakthrough. Both that and the high ball, really, were great breakthroughs in the war.
Did you have a sense of destiny? I mean, was the atmosphere with the team, was it electric at times, knowing that this was such important work, or feeling it was such important work?
I think so, yes. You felt you were playing your part. You really felt you were playing your part. Mind you, were quite separate from the fighting, the misery and wretchedness of the fighting in the front line and North Africa. We had the comfort of home, or I was in digs and things like that, in a hospital, in a hostel. But otherwise, you really enjoyed. And there was a camaraderie. Although I wasn't in the services, it was as being in the service plus, because I had all the civilian privileges, you see. I was quite free.
Fond memories of Felixdale?
Oh, yes. Dear comrades, yes. They're very kind people. It was strange. After the war, the atmosphere changed considerably. Newcomers come in and all the unions started, and you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that.
Mm.
Whereas during the war, what would happen? A project would arise. Now, my husband was in the instrument side. He was in the research and development of instruments. So what would happen? Likes of Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Allen, they'd go into the instrument shop, they'd discuss with Jim what was required, just like that, and it would be on a little piece of paper, and he would suggest to do this, that, and the other to get the best results. Right, you make it, and that was it. And it was all done maybe in a morning over a cup of tea. But after the war, an inspector had to come and do that. He had to go to the drawing office, then it was inspected, then it was inspected on the aircraft, you know, and by that time everybody lost interest in the project. But during the war it was quite different, really was.
Francis McLaren, I hope you'll come and join us again one day. We'll try and get some friends together and have a round table discussion about those days.
I should like that very much. Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a great pleasure and a privilege to have you indeed. Francis McLaren, goodbye.